This is From the Front Line. I'll be your host today, Daniel DeVilliers, and we're privileged to have with us today in the studio Dr. Philip Stotts. He has been teaching on creation evangelism and on science for quite some time now. And so we've just recently finished a biblical worldview summit, wherein he was able to present a variety of different lectures on the way that we approach scriptures and to do so from a biblical worldview with that as our foundation. So we'd like to discuss this morning some of the impact of creation in our understanding of the gospel. And I wonder, Dr. Stott, if you could maybe open our time together with addressing that just more broadly. How does our understanding of creation impact our understanding of the gospel?
Well, our understanding of creation doesn't just affect our understanding of the gospel. It affects our understanding of everything. Because creation can only be explained in two ways, one of two ways. And for centuries, for millennia, the thinking people of the world, the philosophers, have realized that either the creation had to be created by a creator, or else it had to create itself. There are no other possibilities. Now, if you are persuaded that the creation was created by a creator, then you have a problem. A creator wouldn't have created everything unless he had a reason. He wouldn't have created us if he didn't have a reason for our existence. And that raises the possibility that at some stage he may ask us, what did we do with the opportunities he gave us as being part of his creation? Now, if on the other hand, you are convinced that the creation created itself, then your whole outlook is different because, well, if nobody created you, you're your own boss. If things just happened by chance and created themselves, well, you're never going to have to answer to anybody. You can do whatever you please, whatever you think is going to bring you the most satisfaction or whatever else you want out of life. So this question, it rules every aspect of our life and how we are going to live it. Are we going to live it with no restrictions, or are we going to live it with thought to the future where we may be called to account? Now, I can understand that most people would want to believe the second alternative, because after all, if I don't have to be accountable to anybody, I can do what I want, I can live my life the way I want, it's my body, I can do with it whatever I want. And I should imagine that most people in the world would much prefer to believe that worldview so they could do whatever they like. And as far as I can see, the only reason why anyone would choose the other alternative it is because they see the evidence as being so strong that it would be foolish not to believe it. Now, for almost the whole history of mankind, which goes back something like 6,000 years, all civilizations have based their worldview on some religion which needed some kind of a creator or creators, a god or gods. And it's only in the 20th century when a system was brought together which was based on the other worldview. There was not a creator. The universe created itself. And that political system, that worldview, underlay communism, the first civilization, one could say, based on atheism. And we can see a completely different society, a completely different worldview on the society which was built on no creator, and the societies which have been built on the idea of there being a creator. So our understanding of the gospel is dependent on our worldview. The communists tried to crush completely the gospel, saying this is the opium of the people. It's just something to misguide the poor, unintelligent people into thinking that they've got to behave according to a moral standard. Whereas the society that they wished to displace was convinced that they would have to answer at some stage to a creator to give account of their life. And those two societies are completely different.
And those implications, even within the communistic world, is of great importance. Interesting even that when the Iron Curtain collapsed and the Soviet Union dissolved, that there were opportunities that you had to bring lectures into universities throughout Russia, exposing some of those fallacies of evolutionism, presenting scientific evidences for creation. But maybe we could address, even within the church, there's so much of a leaning toward this theistic evolution. That is to say, could God not have used evolution within his framework of creating the world? Why do you sense, even from, if we were to say, from a Christian worldview, or at least from the vantage of a Christian worldview, that so much of this theistic evolution has become very mainstream within our churches?
Now, unfortunately, there have been many Christians who have been persuaded that evolution can be fitted into Christianity. And they have been persuaded because so much emphasis has been put on the infallibility of science. It's almost a ticket to being taken seriously if you say this is science or this is scientific. That crushes all opposition because, well, science is the top. And that attitude has pervaded the church, sadly. Now, I have, on several occasions, had the opportunity to debate with atheists about evolution, and I've had the opportunity to debate with theistic evolutionists. Now, the difference there is, an atheist, you can challenge his theory, you can show the weaknesses, you can show, in fact, that there are such huge weaknesses that it's not tenable. Now, a wonderful example of an atheist coming to see that evolution is untenable was the rejection of evolution by one of the most famous philosophers of the last century, whose name was Anthony Flew, and he had been a wonderful supporter of evolution. He was a very good author and speaker, and Richard Dawkins held him up as his hero. He was so eloquent in supporting atheism. But one day, he made an announcement and he said, it is impossible for evolution to account for the fact that one single cell can carry more information than the entire set of Encyclopedia Britannicas. Now, that is true. It is impossible for evolution to explain all that information. And he gave up evolution and became a believer in intelligent design. On the other hand, you come to a Christian theistic evolution, you point out to him all these errors in evolution, like, for example, the inability to explain information. But the theistic evolutionist could say, oh, yes, but God does miracles. It's not impossible to God. Now, my immediate reaction to this was, well, if you believe in God, why don't you believe the way he said he did it? You can see the way he said he did it in the Bible. But the trouble is, when evolution is so ingrained in a Christian's worldview, and he is just so confident God can do anything, well, God chose to use evolution, and who are you to say he didn't? So it is much easier for a theistic evolutionist to cling on to all this baggage that he has accepted over the years than to give it up and accept that all his twisting and fiddling of the Bible in order to make it fit with evolution is all wrong. It is as difficult for him to give up that baggage as it is for an evolutionist. But an evolutionist can see, well, I have no excuse. Whereas the theistic evolutionist always has this excuse. God can do miracles. He did it.
And that seems like it could have quite wide-reaching repercussions for even our approach of Scripture and how we understand God. How might a framework that starts with evolution and says that God can really do anything the way he wants, how might that affect the way that we approach the Scriptures at large to try to understand then who our God is?
Well, I think this is the reason why the church on the whole is in such a bad state. Because in order to twist the Bible to fit evolutionism, you have to adopt the clever reasoning of someone like Hugh Ross. Now, I've come across many intelligent Christians, particularly scientists, who look to Hugh Ross as having the answers to why evolution can be accepted. And he comes up with cunning and devious explanations. For example, how can it be that the Bible says that God created the sun, moon, and stars on day four, and the plants were created on day three? Now, that wouldn't be a problem if they hadn't accepted what the evolutionists say about the universe being billions of years old. Well, for that to be true, they have to say, well, these days of creation, they're whole geological eons, vast amounts of time. And you confront them with, how did these plants created in this third geological age survive all these millions of years to this fourth geological age when they cannot exist without sunshine? So Hugh Ross comes up with a cunning answer, and he says, well, on the first day light was created, and that must have been the sun. But you couldn't see it because there was a sort of very thick atmosphere, and there was dust and there was clouds, and you couldn't see the sun, but you could see a little bit of light seeping through, and there was enough light seeping through for many, many years for the plants that were created to get enough light for photosynthesis so they could last until on the day four. It's not that the sun was created, but the cloud and the dust, they thinned out so much that at last the sun could be seen. Now, you see, this kind of devious attempting to fit the wisdom of this world into the the wisdom of God, it completely destroys any real credibility in the Bible. It gives the impression you can interpret what the Bible says in any way you want to fit in with any way of thinking you want. And that means when it comes to things like marriage is honourable among all and the marriage bed is undefiled, but fornicators and adulterers God will judge. Well, now you have to apply a whole lot less twisting to the scriptures to interpret that to mean, oh, well, you can be as promiscuous as you like. It would be a good idea, though, just to avoid having illegitimate children, because it seems as if when you look at the book of Malachi, he wanted godly offspring. That's really the only reason he called for marriage. So, you know, as long as now we've got contraceptives so there aren't these ungodly children, we can be as promiscuous as we like. Now, that is a lot easier to come to than this story that Hugh Ross has persuaded people to believe in Genesis chapter 1. And that means you can disregard every single thing in the Bible by producing a cunning enough story to get around it.
Let's look for a minute then at what the biblical picture of creation really puts forward. How could you maybe summarize for us the picture that we have from scriptures and how God created the earth?
Well, all you have to do to see what God says is to do what Jesus said, and that is to become as a little child. Now, if you're going to come as a little child, you're not going to bring in all these super clever stories. You're just going to treat it as if you were a child and God, our Father, is telling us the truth. Now, in telling us the truth, he's not going to bring in wild and woolly stories like the one we heard from Hugh Ross. So if we approach the Bible with that attitude, we look at Genesis chapter 1, and we find, for example, that in the beginning, the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. Now, if we accept that in the beginning God was hovering over the waters, that immediately means we cannot believe the Big Bang theory. Because the Big Bang theory has, in the beginning, there was nothing except a quantum wormhole, and out of it came tons and tons, billions, billions of tons of hydrogen. And over billions of years, this hydrogen came together to form clouds, and that was compressed to form stars. And in the stars, there were nuclear reactions that created heavy elements like oxygen. Then, after a few more billion years, the heavy elements that were released from the stars now allowed oxygen to come in contact with hydrogen. Now we could have water billions of years after the beginning. So we can immediately see, we can reject the Big Bang in toto. Well, God then says, in the midst of these waters, he created a firmament, which he called heaven. And we can see later on in the chapter, but that firmament is what today we would call space. Because after he stretched it out, he put the sun, the moon, and the stars there. But before he did that, on day four, he tells us that from the waters below, he separated the waters out and made dry land appear, and he created the plants, trees, fruit, creating more or less the world we have today on day three. And then on day four, he makes the sun, the moon, the stars, and he sets them in this space that he has created between the waters below, which is now the earth, and the waters above, which we're not told anything more about them in the Bible. We don't know what changes, if any, happened there. But we are told in Psalm 148 that they're still there. This is a psalm where his creation is praising him, and he calls for praise from the heights, from the stars, from the heavens, and the waters that be above the heavens. So the only thing that we are certain of about the waters above the heavens, they are also a testimony to his glory. Well, if we have that view of creation, we obviously cannot believe anything at all about the Big Bang. It should be obvious that since they start with hydrogen and millions of years later come up with oxygen, it can't be the right model. So we shouldn't believe anything about it anyway. And we look at the model of the Bible, where we have the Earth in the centre, we have the space, the firmament of the heavens with the sun, moon and stars, and beyond that we have the waters above. And the only thing that I can see in the Bible we know beyond the waters above, we find in Psalm 8, where it speaks of God who has set his glory above the heavens. So we know his glory is above the heavens. We don't know what else is there until we come into his presence. We will have to say, like Paul, I can only see as through a glass darkly, but one day I will know as I am known, and then we'll know what's beyond the waters above.
Amen. And there are, to our listeners here, there are a tremendous amount of resources that you can continue to look further into this. Several books that Dr. Stott has written, Vital Questions, The Earth is Our Home, Another World, and How the Turtle Got Its Shell. Some great resources that you can look into further. We'd like to leave some time, though, toward the end of our program today to address the ways that we can actually engage in dialoguing about some of these issues. It's one thing to have an understanding, even to come to that understanding of the way that we see our creation from a biblical vantage. But oftentimes when we look to engage in conversations and discussion with those people around us, it can seem crippling where so much is put out towards evolutionary worldviews within and without the church. What are some ways that we can engage in dialogue so as to challenge people's thinking about the scriptures and science?
Well, as far as I can see, the only way nowadays that we can challenge not only the atheists, but also the Christians who've gone astray and now they're believing they can live as they like, is to challenge the origins, the firmness of their foundation, origins. And as has been the case for centuries, there are two possibilities to the question of origins. Either a creator created the creation, or the creation created itself. And the popular worldview, the creation created itself, stands on the Big Bang theory, in which we have the physical matter being created, and on the theory of evolution, in which we have life forms being created. And if we look at the biblical propositions, God created these things, that has stood and been a firm enough solution throughout history to make most people believe there has to have been a creator. And the only reason that the opposite, the creation created itself, could have come into popularity is that enough people must have believed the evidence for the Big Bang and for evolution was strong enough to be a viable solution. Now, it is actually not difficult to challenge the whole idea of the Big Bang. For a start, it is totally unscientific. For one thing, we have watched thousands of explosions. Every single one of them required something to go bang. The Big Bang had nothing to go bang. It just went bang anyway. Every explosion that's ever been observed destroyed information, order, and structure. This Big Bang, which we're asked to believe in, created all the organization, structure, and information in the entire universe. This is totally unscientific. Absolutely unscientific. And the evidence for this story is very, very flimsy. In fact, there is almost nothing in the Big Bang which has been anywhere close to being proved. So it should not be even allowed to call it a theory. A scientific theory is supposed to have some proof to make you think it might be true. There has never been any proof for any aspect of the Big Bang. Not one single aspect. And every aspect of it has had to have ad hoc theories added to explain why, well, it's impossible to get these things to happen now. It's impossible to describe the way the existing structures that we see in the universe come from it. You have to have ad hoc theories to explain angular momentum. You have to have ad hoc theories to explain why all this material shooting out of the Big Bang could possibly have come together in clouds, and even if it did, that they could possibly have been squashed together to form stars. All these things are mathematical impossibilities, and you have to invent totally unsupported hypotheses to get any of these things to work. Then you come to evolution, and all of the stories that I've ever heard put together to explain it have been disproved. I studied biology at Wits University in the early 1970s, and in the biology classes, we were told lots and lots of examples of evolution having happened in the past. Every single one of them has been debunked. And yet, the evolution textbooks today are still putting forward those same debunked stories, like the evolution of the horse and the whale and vestigial organs and embryos all looking the same and gradually becoming more like the creatures that they eventually end up in. All this was debunked years before they were taught to me at Wits. In fact, the embryo story was debunked almost 100 years before I was taught it at Wits. And they're still in the textbooks now. Why? Because they haven't got any stories that they know are true. They have to carry on using the ones that have been shown to be totally false. And then there's the problem of the second law of thermodynamics, which is the most fundamental law in the whole universe. And it's obvious that the theory of evolution, just like the Big Bang theory, contradicts the second law of thermodynamics. And the scientist, Ernest Rutherford, said, if your theory contradicts the second law of thermodynamics, there is no hope for it. It must collapse in total humiliation. So these theories, which are used to support the idea that the universe could have created itself, they are so thoroughly debunked that any honest person, like Anthony Flew, will say, well, look, evolution can't explain these things, and then accept that the creation must have been created by a creator of some sort. So for any person to be brought round to Christianity, all you have to do is challenge them with their worldview's account of the origins. And the only account of the origins which stands up and is consistent is the story of the Bible. And you may find people saying, oh, well, that can't be true, but you show that their stories can't be true, and why cannot it be true that a creator created the creation? And if they say, oh, well, who created the creator? Well, that is not a question that we are in any position to answer, because our experience, our knowledge, our ability to reason, it is totally about the material universe that we have been brought in, we can see around us. And it is absolutely obvious that the creator is not part of his creation. He is far greater than his creation, just as a painter is far greater than the picture that he paints on a piece of canvas. And just because a painting on a piece of canvas cannot talk or express itself doesn't mean to say that the painter who created it cannot talk or express himself. And just because we are enclosed within this three-dimensional world that we can see and experience does not mean that the creator who made this creation that we can see is constrained to it. Even the mathematicians and the scientists have come to the conclusion there must be more dimensions than we can see. And there are theories being put forward by the scientists and the mathematicians to try and explain this universe that we are part of, but which they simply cannot explain its origin. And they are working, they're always working in terms of four, five, six, more. The string theory and brain theory that they're trying to work with, they have many dimensions. And, well, if there are many dimensions and we can't see anything other than the three we're in, why can these same scientists not accept that this creator who created the universe we live in inhabits a realm which includes this creation but is far greater? It has other dimensions or aspects that we are not able to make any comment on, and we have no idea how that came into being, and we have no means of asking the right questions to find out.
Well, Dr. Stott, I appreciate the concern that you've got in conversing. It sounds not only with people outside of the church, but also within the church, and both of those, and sharing, on the one hand, like you mentioned, where we can come to fellow believers within the church and bring them back to a proper understanding of the scriptures, a consistent understanding of the scriptures, so that we don't simply approach God as arbitrary and to be able to understand however we'd like, but in a consistent way as we look through the pages of Scripture to see his revelation to us, and yet also to see the way that we can engage with people that have no connection to the church or association with the Bible, but call them even to consider, in light of the testimony that God's given us in creation, how that points to a creator, and a creator that has revealed himself even in his word. I so appreciated the way that you began even at the Biblical Worldview Summit with an understanding of the eternal gospel that we find wrung out from Revelation 14, pointing to the fact that God reigns because he has created the world and all within it. And it's so central in the way that we understand who God is, in that he is creator and he has the say as to how this world has been put together and to even the purpose that it has. So thank you so much for joining us, not only for the summit that we've recently come through, but also here today. We also have the privilege of getting to hear from Dr. Stott some more tomorrow. There's a webinar from 10 o'clock to 4 o'clock here in South Africa, as a small educational webinar that we have going on. If those of you who are here in Cape Town area in South Africa are welcome to join along here at the mission. And to those of you who aren't able to make it, we'll be live streaming that from 10 to 4. So be sure to check out the information on Frontline's website to find more ways that you can access that. And also on Thursday evening, Dr. Stott will be sharing at our Reformation Society on where in the universe are we. So we greatly look forward to each of those. Wednesday's topic for the webinar will be on real science versus science falsely so-called. Would you like to just share a few minutes of the focus of that time tomorrow, the prayer for how we can be focusing our attention and our thoughts through that webinar?
Now, science is being used as a term to cow all opposition. Science, that knows everything. Now, the problem is that science is a Christian discipline which was effectively put forward as a means of finding out truth by Francis Bacon. And his reason for putting it forward was that he pointed out that we would have it that nature behaves the way we think it should. So he brought forward the scientific method, which demands that we start with measurements and observations, and then we find patterns in those measurements and observations. We put forward hypotheses to explain the patterns. We have to do experiments which have not been done before to see if they agree with that hypothesis. And then if we find any observations that disagree with the hypothesis, we must abandon it and look for a better hypothesis. Now, that is the way most people think science still works. That worldview, that approach to science, fitted very well with the early scientists who practiced science because they were all Christians. They read of God, and they read that he says he is to be seen in the things he has made, in his creation. They also read that he is a reasonable God and he's a law-giving God. So it made sense to think that looking into his creation, they could find out something about the way he does things. Johannes Kepler, for example, said the privilege of a scientist is thinking God's thoughts after him. So real science is a search for the truth about the way the Creator's creation works. Now, in about 1840, a group of American scientists started trying to raise their status by making science a very prestigious profession. And to do that, they started introducing rules. to call yourself a scientist, you have to have a qualification that they recognize from a university they recognize. You have to publish your research in journals which they recognize as being science journals. And this kind of restriction was put in, and they wanted to make themselves apart from society. They wanted it to be a prestigious occupation, and they loved hiding behind technical jargon and complex mathematics. Well, that has led to a complete shift in science. Instead of now looking for the truth and seeing how God's creation works, now scientists are looking for status, and they're happy to go into abstruse things which the normal person just does not have the intellectual tools, the mathematical tools to understand. And they have not been at all concerned about truth. They have been concerned about what they want to propagate. Now, these people who set themselves up as the scientific establishment, they are secular humanists and atheists. The original scientists weren't. They were looking for the way God's creation worked. The secular humanists say there is no God. They say, even if there is such thing as truth, we probably couldn't find it. And they claim not to be looking for truth, but for looking for useful theories. And this is a totally different approach. And the science that they have brought in, they have enforced by approaching all the universities and telling them that if they get their scientists to publish in their journals, then they will be given a lot of money. And the universities rely on this money, so they produce a list of journals every year and distribute it around the staff and say, you must publish in these journals. But these journals have a set of holy cows and a set of prohibited items. So you may publish papers that support evolution. You may not publish a paper which criticizes or suggests in any way that evolution may not be true. You may publish papers which support the Big Bang or any other secular theory, but you may not criticize those theories. And anything to do with pure secularism, that's fine. But all your explanations have to be purely materialistic. And they have completely taken over science, and these limitations they put on publications have meant that many truths are barred from the scientific publications. So there are scientists who are having to publish in other journals. Now, there are people who support those journals because they know these are journals telling the truth, but the universities don't want you to publish there. They don't get any money. So this attitude, it has had a disastrous effect on science, and the truth is suppressed because if it disagrees with any sacred cows, no matter where it's published, it is not classed as science. And what is allowed to be science is restricted to ideas that the secular humanists approve of. So it's really no longer science at all. I think this is what Paul was pointing to when he said to Timothy, don't be led astray by science falsely so called.
And that's so true, and we look greatly forward toward hearing more of that, considering that together as to where science went wrong and how we can be redeeming our understanding of science, our approach of science, from that biblical framework, with understanding as to some of those ways that it's being used today. So we very much appreciate your engagement now with us, and also tomorrow are looking forward to that time together. To those who are listening, be sure to check out more of the resources that are available on Frontline's website at frontlinemissionsa.org. You can check out our Facebook pages where we'll be live streaming the webinar tomorrow. And there will also be a quite a considerable time for question and answer to engage in text and in writing in questions that we'll be addressing during that webinar. So do be sure to track along with that as much as you're able, and we'll be able to then release that after the fact. And those who are able on Thursday evening to join us, we'll be streaming that as well. Thank you so much for joining us on From the Frontline. We look forward to seeing you next time.